Do the trashy pulp novels of the world have anything to offer? Are bestsellers all they're cracked up to be? Here at Terrible Book Club, we explore whether you really can judge a book by its cover or its ridiculous synopsis. You ever passed a book and thought, ugh, who's reading this? We probably are.
Welcome to episode 187 of the Terrible Book Club. I'm Paris, and this is Chris.
Hello!
This time, we bring you a two-part episode about childhood nostalgia. We decided to return to what we were reading as kids to see if any of it has held up over the years. Chris remembered reading the entire Hardy Boys series as a child, and Paris, me, I recall... And I recalled my love of the Dear America series of books. So we presented each other with lists of our beloved childhood series, and we each picked what we thought could probably be the worst one from each list. So I chose Hardy Boys 55, The Witchmaster's Key by Franklin W. Dixon, although this is like one of those conglomerate corporate pen names, so the true author was
my childhood is shattered by that knowledge.
This is a little diversion you can take on your own, listeners, if you want to read about all of the people involved in the Hardy Boys, including a woman who was just, her stories were just taken and they just renamed them with men names. But anyway, I think The Witchmaster's Key was written by Vincent Buranelli. There is a whole table. I think Wikipedia has like a whole table with like, okay, if the book was written in this period, it's probably this person or these people who wrote it. But it is tough to figure out. In any case, Chris chose Dear America, Down the Rabbit Hole, The Diary of Pringle Rose by Susan Campbell Bartoletti. And we will talk about that in part two. Today is part one. The next time you hear this is part two. We're bending time again, everyone. I'm sorry. It's happening.
That's the theme of season 9 is time dilation.
All right, Chris, what do we do here at Terrible Book Club?
If this is your first time listening to us, what we do here at the Terrible Book Club is read books that we assume will be bad based on their cover, title, summary, or some combination of the three. Sometimes we read books that our patrons, listeners, or friends, or just us to each other recommend. So we do the opposite of what most people do in a bookstore or while they're browsing the internet. Usually this experiment results in a disappointing read, but once in a while we end up liking the book. So as for content warnings, today's show includes our usual barnyard language. There's some occult stuff. There's some Satan-y, witchy stuff happening if you care about that. There's like a little bit of maybe light kidnapping here and there. And just general Scooby-Doo tomfoolery is the name of the
game.
Did
you forget the torture chamber? Because that's probably a warning for some people.
I wrap that up in kidnapping. Yeah.
Well, kidnapping and torture are two distinct things, so.
Usually, if you get one, you get the other. So, you know.
Is there a statistic on that? I don't know.
Yeah, don't trust me. You're right. There is also a little bit of torture with the kidnapping. But I don't know how much Scooby-Doo gets up to that. But the general feel of it is I would have gotten away with it if it wasn't for you meddling Hardys.
Yeah, to be fair, the torture happens over the course of perhaps 5 minutes and then ends abruptly. So it's not a big deal.
Like a lot of things in this book. All right, how about I hit you with the back of the book summary?
Great, thank you.
There is not time for explanations when Mr. Hardy telephones Frank and Joe from the West Coast and sends them flying off to England to help his old friend, Professor Robotham. Their stay in East Anglia begins with a weird omen as they witness the bizarre funeral of an old witchmaster. From then on, strange things happen. When the Hardys learn about the strange disappearance of Lord Craighead, the plot deepens. Danger follows them to Ireland as Frank and Joe survive a shipwreck and find a clue from a frightened white witch that leads to the torture chamber of a black witch's coven, all in search of the telltale Witchmaster's Key.
Thank you, Chris. I can go ahead and do the characters and setting and the summary since you wrote the summary this time. It's always more fun when the one who didn't write it has to read it. All right, our characters, Joe and Frank Hardy, they are the titular Hardy boys, although apparently the Hardy crew usually includes a couple of other dudes who do randomly appear for a hot second, but ultimately do not matter. So don't worry about them. Joe and Frank Hardy's dad, Mr. Hardy, I don't remember his first name. It also doesn't matter. Professor Rowbottom in England. Milton Craighead and Co., who live in the castle next door to the professor. The evil Black Witch Coven and all its, you know, denizens. And similarly, the White Witch Coven, who are there for like half a second later. I don't know any other. Oh, there's Mr. Eames and the daughter. They do end up mattering in the solution of the plot. I think Eves or Eames. Anyway, moving on.
Kinda.
Yeah, it's,
sort of.
It's the 70s. We are in England, and then we are also in Ireland for a little bit, right? And then the Isle of Man, I believe.
Yes.
All right. Here is our summary that we present to you so that you don't have to read this thing, and you can sort of understand what we're talking about when we start screaming later on about how much we detest this book. This was written by Chris, so I'll be reading it today. Frank and Joe Hardy are on the case in East Anglia because their dad couldn't be bothered coming all the way out there to solve the mystery of how someone stole an entire museum like all of it. It was a collection of witch artifacts owned by Professor Rowbottom, and he's stumped as to who could have done it. So Frank and Joe head to England, but stop at the dentist's office because Joe has a toothache. The dentist shows him his weird mask collection he keeps under a trap door beneath the dental chair in his exam room. Sure. Frank and Joe then run into Nip, the stable boy for Milton Craighead, outside, and get into a scuffle. Maybe he stole it since he's a jerk. Maybe it's the locksmith with a bunch of medieval weapons and armor in his locksmith shop who tries to trap them. Maybe it's the fortune teller lady who pokes Frank with the needle and drugs him. Don't worry, there was a doctor right outside with the right thing to inject Frank with to reverse the first injection. Maybe it's the terrorists who opened fire in the airport at... Wait, no, the cops got them immediately, and they're never mentioned again. Maybe it's the people dressed up in druid outfits on a foggy night in Stonehenge who attack the brothers. Maybe it's the lady who offers them a ride home after the professor fucks off because some guy said, yeah, the Hardy Boys said to leave. It's cool. See you later. Maybe it's the dog that spooks them on the way back to the professor's castle. Or the witches that are like, pay us money to see the special exhibit of new witch items that definitely aren't the stolen ones you're looking for. Well, it's mostly none of them. It's actually just the dentist dressed as Satan, who's in charge of the needle lady and a few other people in town. They needed the witch stuff to sell to fund their occult practices, which is weird because wouldn't those items be of more value to you as objects used in ritual? I guess castle taxes are just too damn high. Everyone gets arrested, and then Joe and Frank also solve the property scheming stuff that was going on with the locksmith and Matthew Hopkins that no one cared about. The end.
Wow.
Wowie.
Yeah, so as you can see, there's a lot of suspects. There's a lot of perps to comb through here. But honestly, we're not going to comb through too much of that. It's just so much ridiculousness happening here. So let's get into the rubric, Paris.
Yes, let's get into the rubric, Chris. Take it away.
Okay, technical construction and layout. This is an easy one for this book. I mean, usually this is an easy one unless the, you know, Tereblo levels are also kind of high. But periods are where they're supposed to be. Sentences are sentencing here for the most part. Format is fine.
Yeah, no strangeness. I mean, this was clearly edited for, at least for, you know, construction. Not edited for plot, clearly, which we'll talk about shortly. But, you know, punctuation is where it's supposed to be. The chapters are chaptering. We don't have any weirdness here. It's a very, very easy to read. So, yeah, I think this gets a solid one for technical construction and layout. Great.
Yeah, we can just breeze right on by this and then get into the part that we will not breeze by. At all. Plot and characters.
All right. right. General coherence. Where are we?
Low.
Where are we on the scale?
Low coherence is what is happening here.
This is absolute fucking utter nonsense. I mean, all right. I've just listed a bunch of things that are nonsensical about this. I don't even think I got all of them. So
yeah, so we can't do every yeah. last one, man. Like, I will just say that, like, coming back to the Hardy Boys after a decade and a half, maybe, probably longer. I think the last time I read a Hardy Boys book, I was perhaps 11 or 12. And
I was
going to
say, Chris,
late.
I hope you weren't
that
19
feels
when
late.
You last read this, because that would be a decade and a half.
Like, what's Frank and Joe up to over there? But, like, coming back to, I don't know, maybe by number 55, they're, like, extra phoning it in or something, but it is real loosey-goosey with a lot of stuff here, and I think the main problem is that they get into scrapes that are immediately resolved with no consequence whatsoever, and the way they get in and out of these scrapes is absolute nonsense. Let's just start with, they're hired to investigate a crime and are sent overseas.
Underage.
But they have no idea.
They are underage. They are 17. I guess they're both the same age. Are they twins?
No, Frank is 19.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Well,
Frank
he's 19.
Is 19 and Joe is 17.
Excuse me. One of
which
them's
in the
underage.
70s, I don't even think that's underage. Like, you know, they were loosey-goosey back
in
then.
In the 70s, that's solidly middle-aged. They were totally fine.
Okay. Anyway, so they get sent to England. And I guess because dad called him and was like, hey, listen, I'm not doing this shit. The professor called me up. Go see what he's bitching about. Go get a ticket or something. Like how do they accept that without, like,
I know.
Well, what kind of case?
They're not even told what kind of crime occurred. They could have been walking into a murder or a sexual assault or, I don't know, like, of any number
what
of things.
What if they just showed up and the professor was like, I can't find my keys? And they're like, what do you mean?
I mean, that is kind of what happened. The professor was like, I can't find my big ass witch key.
I can't find my museum. Did you guys see where I left my museum? So I guess that's the second point is that the whole museum, all of the museum got stolen. Every last bit.
Right. He has a castle or like a large manor. I'm unsure which it is. And All of the floors, like this, or the top two floors and the basement are like full of occult artifacts, and someone stole all of it, even the basement and the sub basement. I forgot, and they cleared the sub basement in a single night without like arousing the suspicions of the guy who lived there.
He was home the whole time. They didn't like distract him.
What?
Like. There's like it's metal things coming out of there, like multiple, like many trips. This is not like
a chest
I can
of
do
coins
it in one...
falling all over the place.
This is not like I can do it in one trip, multiple grocery bag situation. I don't care how strong you are. You're not taking the whole bait. Like, I can do it in one trip. But
how many people did they have, and what if they all did that? What if it was 100 people and they
I
all had
I don't care
our disease?
If it's 20 people filing into the museum. And taking it like as much as they possibly can. I'm assuming in the dead of night, like actually I don't know exactly when supposedly it was stolen.
It was overnight. Again, it was at night at some point. So it was
the professor
was
home. I guess he's taken some real strong Ambien or something.
Laudanum or something. I don't know.
he's out, dude. He's gone for the evening.
So that's all. So the crime itself is already pretty unbelievable. I mean, like you said, maybe the professor is just on some like really sick night juice and he was just fucking out and like the butler was off that day, right? So they knew the butler wasn't going to be there.
Which, by the way, absolves the butler of the crime later
yeah,
on.
Because
the butler
Chris,
was like, I wasn't even working that day. And he was there. Like, okay, I guess it wasn't you then.
But like, you can't do workplace crime if you're off the clock. That's like how it works.
True.
Right?
I would punch. Are you kidding me? I'm getting paid for that workplace crime while yeah, also crime there. Are you kidding me?
What an absurd idea. Oh, you weren't at work, therefore you couldn't have committed a crime. And it's like, well, wouldn't that be a good time to commit the crime? Because you're not
well,
punched
Frank
in?
And Joe like, are also, like, suspected of some bullshit early in the book. And then the professor was like, it's okay, I know their dad from America. And then the UK cops are like, I guess that's fine.
Yeah, the police in this are buffoons. But yeah, continuing on like the general, the weird or the lack of coherence.
Sorry, we can really get off track here easily.
So they arrive in England and they're like, all right, well, you know, guess we got to like get to our hotel. And then I forget, which was it, Joe who had the toothache? The toothache?
Joe had the toothache.
So Joe's like, one of my teeth really hurts. And you know, Frank's like, all right, well, it seems like we should probably get this out of the way. Like, if we got to investigate a crime, we can't be doing it with your tooth hurting, which is fine. Totally normal logic. But then things immediately take a fucking turn, right? They are heading into town where their hotel is, and they come across like an occult funeral happening in broad daylight, and they crash the funeral. So they like see the procession and they're like, I don't know, that looks fucking weird. Let's like go crash this funeral. And so they just like hide behind like a tree or some shrubs and they watch this funeral happen. And then other, you know, understandably, people at the funeral are like, what are you doing here? And they're like, and then they get like conked in the head and tossed
behind the bushes.
In the grave.
You can just watch us. It's okay. You can just watch us for a sec.
But then they get conked, right? Or is that later? I don't remember.
I think they're conked. Like this one, they're like the funeral
they come
people
back.
Are dressed.
They come back. Right. Sorry. Yeah. Excuse me. They're just being fucking creeps in the bushes, and the funeral people are like, what the hell?
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Fellas?
And I don't know what would possess you. Because again, they didn't know what the crime was. So they had no reason to care about this funeral, and the only thing
I think the funeral procession was vaguely witchy. Like, it had like a little bit of Salem, Massachusetts vibes.
But the only thing occult about it was there was one woman holding a black cat and the guy at the front was holding a sword.
That's enough. That's weird enough where they're like, again, there's some Satan shit happening. There's a black cat and a sword.
But again, like, they didn't know that they were going to investigate a crime involving the occult. So why were they attracted to the funeral? Like, it just doesn't make sense. This guy's got a toothache. They're going to solve a crime. And they're like, I don't know. Let's take this fucking detour to this graveyard. Like, what? So after that happens, they then pursue a dentist. And they, you know, they go to the inn and they're like, yo, who's your dentist? And they're like, oh, he's this guy. Go there. And they're like, all right. They go to the dentist, like, kind of late. And they show up and the dentist like comes out of a trap door under his dentist chair and they're like, and instead of being freaked out and finding another dentist, the dentist is like, come into my trap hole beneath my dentist chair. And they're like, sick. Yeah, that sounds totally
fine. Sounds cool.
Fine.
Let's go. What? Let's fucking go, bro.
So they go in there. And the dentist is like,
Paris, I don't care what kind of dentist office I'm in. I would never go in the trapdoor under the dental chair.
No.
Never for anything. There's no way you could convince me under there.
Even if I knew the dentist, even if it was a dentist I had known my whole life, I'm not going in the trapdoor under the dental chair. This is a random dude they've never seen in their fucking lives. And they're like, yeah, dental hole. So they go down there. And the dentist is like, oh, yeah, this is my mask-making shop. It's very convenient because it is directly under my dental chair.
Okay,
and they just accept that, and they're like, okay, I guess he's a thespian? Like, all right, that's fine.
Yeah,
and
he's then, like, oh, it's for my acting troupe.
Yeah, and then he gives them two masks that make them look Irish, which is kind of fucked up anyway.
Yeah,
like, it's kind of weird. It's like, oh, okay. And they're like, wow, cool, Mr. Dennis. And then he's like, all right, Joe, get up in the chair. And then he rips Joe's tooth out. No anesthetic, no pain medication given for like aftercare. This he's just like, yeah, feels great. What? I don't care. I don't care if this is the 70s. Like, if anything, in the 70s, he should have been like, here's some good shit, Joe.
Like, bro, you want to... I've given you what the professor had. That's what happened. Like, he gave all of the dental drugs to the professor. The professor got knocked out the whole night. And now he's like, really, like, I kind of gave it all away. I don't have anything to give you guys. So, you know what? We're just... It's good old 1, 2, 3 here.
I just
ready?
Can't imagine getting a tooth pulled... Without anesthetic and then also not given any pain medication for afterward. Like, I mean, I know that obviously in the course of human history, this has happened, but this is the 1970s in England. Like,
it's not nice.
What? Yeah, it's not good. So that was bizarre. And of course, the variety of the occult is full-on satanic panic flavor. You've got, like, a mushy pile of New Age hysteria. You've got literally abracadabra, black cats and crones, fortune telling.
Witchy person just shouting abracadabra, abracadabra, abracadabra at them as if it's like a horrible spell that is good. Like, we always think of abracadabra as like the bullshit spell for when you're like pulling your thumb away from, you know, to trick a toddler.
Yeah, I mean, that, and you've got witches serving Satan, witches wear special power masks and Native American headdresses, and then feathers are used to make witches. You know, it's all this absolute horseshit that has no bearing on actual, you know, occult practice or even sort of your garden variety, you know, witch shit today. It's, again, really satanic panel. That's what he should call this. That's what they call the trap door beneath the dentist chair. The satanic.
That's it. There you go.
But yeah, full satanic panic flavor here, which makes it all the more silly and hard to enjoy. You know, also they're working on this case and somehow they find time to play a game of rugby and then recruit random local kids into their investigation. Like, they go to Ireland, they're like, oh, this Pat kid seems kind of cool. We played rugby with him. I don't know. I get he, and he's just there. They're like, all right, why don't you do the stakeout? And Pat's like, what the fuck? Like, I just met you guys 3 hours ago. Why am I at a stakeout?
What do you mean stakeout? I don't got shit to do, dude.
I'm a 16-year-old child. So that was odd. The whole reason they're in Ireland at all, they go to Ireland. I think they're specifically on the Isle of Man, right? And...
yes.
They go there because one of the two times they were like bonked or punched in the throat or whatever and knocked out.
Conked by goons, excuse me.
Yes. One of the goon conquerings, they found a hat that was left behind by presumably one of the goons, although they're not totally sure. And the hat, I don't know. They're like, let's go to where this hat came from, which to me seems absolutely fucking dumb. Why would you be like, oh man, this guy's hat came from H&M. Let's go to the nearest H&M and be like, do you know who you sold this hat to?
Who bought this hat?
I mean,
and they're gonna be like, I don't fucking know. What do you we got 50 of those things.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess in this situation, right, it's the 70s. We're not talking about fast fashion like H&M. But,
sure.
You know, they're like, oh, it came from this place on the Isle of Man. So they're like, let's go all the way there. So they do. They go to the shop and they ask the shopkeeper, hey, do you know who this hat belongs to? And the shopkeeper's like, no, but is like doing the big eyebrows at them because he doesn't want, I don't know, the owner or whoever else is there to know that he's going to tip them off. So he like meets them outside on his lunch break a little later and he tells them, yeah, I know who bought that hat because it's got this weird stitching. It's like the stitching's kind of fucked up on it. And they're like, okay, who? And he's like, I'll meet you at the pub later. So they go to a pub and while they're there, the guy from the hat store or whatever, turns out he's a white witch. He's a good witch. He serves Diana.
I really love the like black versus white witch stuff in this because it's like black witches be like this, white witches be like that. Like it was a lot of like trying to delineate when really you're all just doing magic. It's just that the black witches have like a goat mask on during it or something.
Well, yeah, I guess they're torturing people, but you know, that's a problem. But yeah, it's very silly. And so he's like talking to them and then someone throws a dart and it almost hits one of them and hat store guy is like, oh my God, someone threw a dart at you. I'm absolutely going to tell you whose hat that is. And he like spills the tea and you're like,
sure.
What?
Someone makes total sense.
Someone threw a dart, so you feel compelled to tell. I don't understand. Like it's, you're in danger.
Because like the dart thrower is trying to silence the hat store guy, so that makes the hat store guy more courageous to share who owned that hat to Frank and Joe Hardy.
I guess and it turns out it was, he tells them the hat belongs to a black witch from Gryffindor and his alias is He Goat, and they say, and he just says he's an older man who's short. And of course, the only person described in the entire book who's an older man who's short is Goodman, the whatever, the groundskeeper, I forget.
Yes.
So all, and they're like, okay, so it was an inside job. It was like someone, you know, it was the butler all along or something. Or they're like, well, that hat belongs to the butler, so he's one of the guys who attacked us at least.
Oh, you mean the guy that said he wasn't working that day? That makes it impossible. There's no way.
Oh, yeah, of course. You know, and so it just, I just feel like if they had, I don't know, maybe just asked people questions, they never interrogate a single person in this entire criminal case.
They also just let people know that they're investigating the case, like, openly,
yeah,
without any sort of guile or subterfuge. They're just like, yeah, we're looking for who people, did you steal the museum? We're looking for who stole the museum.
Yeah, it's very strange. Couple more things, and then we can move on to the next portion, where we'll just continue to list things that don't make any sense. So, you know, when you're writing a book of fiction, but your fiction touches on real things, personally, I think it makes sense to just ensure that the things that are, you know, touching reality are accurate. I feel like it lends a little more credibility to your fiction and, you know, credibility to you as an author. Your audience can trust you. You're not spreading mis or disinformation, right? This book just, man, they did not care about anything. So there's a like a crest on Gryffindor. I forget if it was Gryffindor or the other castle next door. I forget, one of them. And it's the fucking, can't even say it. I'm laughing already. The crest has a slogan on it, and it said "Avoir la Sorbonne." And I'm not good at French, so I was like, something about it just didn't.
Neither is this author.
Just didn't tickle me right, and I was like, I'm just gonna see what this phrase actually means, because they said it meant to have a strong grip. And I'm like, first of all, that's a fucking weird, like, motto for your family.
Yeah,
crest.
That's a weird thing to have on your castle, is like, hold it tight, grab hard. Like, what? What does this have to do with the castle?
Well, you know, they're really good at tugging dicks or something. I don't know.
Really just strange. Like the kung fu grip.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it struck me because it was a little bit of an odd family motto, and then I was like, I don't know, I just don't trust this book. So many things have happened in this book that already make me distrust the author. So I look it up, and sure enough, it does not mean to have a strong grip. It means to have a good greenhouse.
Oh, nice. Thanks. I mean, I've been working really hard on my greenhouse, so thanks for the blessing.
Actually, I would much prefer that as a family motto, to have a good greenhouse. That's like, that's got so many layers to it. You're like, make sure.
I guess if I had to pick which one goes on my castle, it would be the greenhouse,
right?
One.
Because, you know, you want to have a good greenhouse, right? Like, you want to make sure that you are encouraging, you know, growth and helping your family to flourish, and then you also want to make sure your family
or
has
even just like
food.
As a farmer,
yeah,
like what
right.
If you like came up into nobility from like your farming
right,
prowess and
right.
Stuff, so like that's like a traditional thing, as opposed to just like have a good grip, this family's held on for dear life for millennia.
We're just gripping everyone else's coins and taking them. Like, that was sort of the, you know, the flavor I got. So anyway, yeah, I wish
we've been stealing museums since the Dark Ages.
Should have been to have a good greenhouse. And this happened because this author or editor or publisher, someone, didn't mind their fucking accents, because if they had added the accent on ser or sere, then it would have been the right word to, you know, to have a wasn't even strong grip. It was like to have a, I don't know, it was something similar to that anyway. It was, oh, to hold tightly. But they forgot
Paris,
the accent.
This is America.
So
this is an American book for American people. We don't do any accents, even if it's from in the original language it had an accent. I can't find that on my keyboard, on my typewriter. What are you talking about?
Gotta have the good greenhouse. So that was ridiculous.
You're right. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
And like, secondly, there's this whole, we briefly mentioned earlier, there's this whole second subplot mystery of like arsons at Eagleton Green, which is some like artisan village. And I didn't care about it at all because it didn't matter. It was just an entire red herring to make you think that the people who were involved in that sort of property scheme were maybe also involved with the occult witchcraft stuff, but they weren't at all. And like, why do you need to
just
add
completely
a whole
useless B
second
plot that they didn't even really investigate it that hard. They kind of fell ass backwards to be like, oh, also that, I guess that part was this.
Yes.
Maybe if you didn't go around town announcing that you're investigating shit, you wouldn't be fucked with by the other people that were doing that thing.
Yeah. And so they end up, they get told like, oh, you should go talk to Matthew Hopkins. He's like a real estate guy or something. I forget. Because they were like, oh, I wonder if the fires at Eagleton Green have anything to do with the robbery, right? I don't know, because they're like, I don't know, there's crimes happening. Maybe all the crimes are connected. I have no idea why that's their angle. And they go to see Matthew Hopkins. Yes, the same name as the Witchfinder General. And, you know, he seems fine. He seems maybe a little shady because he's a real estate man, and they're all shady by virtue of their profession, but you know, later on he's talking to a few other people in town and they're like, well, his name's Matthew Hopkins, I mean, that's the same name as the Witchfinder General, like, he's also got to be evil. And they say this with a straight face, like,
the line in the book is like, it's an extreme coincidence for two men to have the same name. And you're like, is it?
Especially when
really?
That name is
that a big
Matthew Hopkins? Like,
were there that many less people in the 70s?
No.
Like, because before it was before baby boomers or something? No, that was after baby boomers. So, like, what do you mean it's weird that two people have the same name? It's not even a weird name.
I know. It's a very standard name. So that was strange. And then, so I guess this was the author's attempt to just really ram in some more like witch and occult shit, because, you know, Matthew Hopkins, if listeners are unaware, was the Witchfinder General for not even 3 full years, between the years of 1644 and 1647. He actually only lived until the age of like 25 to 28. No one's exactly sure. And he, you know, he did witch finding for, I don't know, like 2.5 years, and he retired, wrote The Discovery of Witches, which is about witch finding, and then died. He, you know, the book is like, oh, it turned out he was a witch himself. And like, that's just not true. He was never found to be a witch himself. Although many people suspected that he was in this line of witch finding work only for the pay, because it was pretty fucking good. That dude got $6,000 for every town he visited. That is adjusted.
Whoa, like, that's in, adjusted like for Dark Ages money? What do you?
No. 6,000, that's adjusted for inflation and conversion. So
that
would be like,
okay, I was going to say, like, you're making $6,000 in like the witch finding times. That's like billions of dollars.
Yeah, that would have like bankrupted the entire country. I don't think. But
give you the entire treasury of the whole continent.
Yeah, I mean, so in money of the time, in pounds, in that era,
understood,
it was about 20 to 23 pounds a visit. And even then, because his fees were so high, towns had to like come up with more taxes. They had to establish a fucking Matthew Hopkins like witchfinder tax, because him and his buddies were charging so much money for this.
The witch finding GoFundMe is what you're saying.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Everyone pitch in to find the witches.
Tax to hell, just so they can come by and kill your friends. And you know, the book also suggests that, or it doesn't suggest, it directly states that there's a wand and a crystal ball in the occult collection, and that was Matthew Hopkins' witch equipment. And I was like, Matthew Hopkins never persecuted anyone who was an actual witch. Obviously, it was just like women that, you know, they
really?
Wanted, yeah.
Oh, shit, I didn't know that part.
And so why would he have a wand and a crystal ball? I mean, if they really wanted to fucking shoehorn Matthew Hopkins in here just for, like, more witchy history, they could have said that in the occult collection there were, like, witch blades or witch needles, which were actual things that Matthew Hopkins used to test women for witchcraft. And, like, that just would have made more sense. Like, again, if history is giving you a thing, just fucking take the thing. You don't have to change
it. Like, just look it up.
You don't have to change it. And, like, I know that these authors didn't have the internet, but we still had microfiche. You still had the library. Like, I had to use that shit as a child. I remember it. It worked just fine.
Actually, turns out you didn't have to, Paris. You could just write whatever you want.
Yeah, it turns out.
And
lastly, in this little part, they also mention that Melinda Hardy Smith was an accused witch during the Salem witch trials, because we have to just squeeze Salem in here no matter what, because
name is Hardy. That's all. They just wanted to like have a little connection because
Chris, there isn't a connection.
that person
never existed. And the Salem witch trials are so well documented that information is super easily accessible. There was no one named Melinda Hardy Smith who was ever accused of being a witch during the Salem witch trials.
They're throwing that in there to give the Hardy boy, like, our great-great-great aunt was involved in the Salem witch trials.
No, they don't.
Have that in there for no reason.
No, that's not why. It's in there because one of the black witches says, you should have them locked up, like, he's a witch too, because his grandmother was that. And then the Hardys are like, no, we're not. Like, we don't have any connection to that. And then later in the book, they fucking happen to be near a genealogist or a historian, and they're like, oh yeah, your family came over in the 1800s, and they were like, see, we're not witches. It's so needless. Why?
Okay. I mean, there's also a lot of, like we mentioned before, there's a lot of scrapes they get into that are immediately resolved. We mentioned a lot of these, so I don't have to repeat every single one. But by far, the crowning jewel moment of all of this is they're at the airport trying to go to Ireland, I think.
Yes.
And it's just the end of a chapter, and the name of the game for Hardy Boys, the end of every chapter has to be a little suspense moment, that's like when the dentist comes up out of the floor, is like, then a monster came out of the floor. Wait, it was just the dentist. This time, at the end of this chapter, it's like they're at the airport, and then gunshots ring out, and then the next chapter begins, like, actually, you know what? Let me just read that part.
Yeah, I was going to say,
you should just
read this horrible thing.
Okay. Here's the end of chapter 14 going into chapter 15. Frank hung up and they went to the departure gate where the Dublin flight would originate. Suddenly, three men ran past. The sound of pistol shots rang out. Bullets whined through the airport. Chapter 15. SOS in the Irish Sea. Hit the deck, Joe yelled. He and Frank plunged headlong onto the airport floor. People ran helter-skelter. A number of policemen surged through the frightened crowd, captured the gunmen, and took them off. They're terrorists from abroad shooting at each other, said a bobby. But we got them all. Nobody's been hurt. Thank goodness those guys didn't kill anyone, Joe said. Frank, isn't it a thrill to live in today's world? He added sarcastically.
Woof.
Just to throw in, like, a gunman assault in the airport for the sake of a cheap suspense cliffhanger at the end of chapter 14 of a Hardy Boys book is by far the most needless use of any cliffhanger I've ever seen in any book, period, end of story.
God, and what a sad reminder of the world we live in where, like, you know, in the 70s, they were like, oh, wow, what if this happened? And now we're like, yeah, that fucking happens all the time, and people are dying constantly, and it's really insensitive to have in your book.
Just amazing, really.
Yeah.
So I think that's the crown jewel example of all of it, and there's just a lot of other stuff like that, if you want to like list it really quick.
Yeah, this is sort of the rules following section, and we already talked about some of these because it applied to also the lack of coherence in the plot and the character silliness, but, you know, the rules or expectations this sets out is that we are supposed to be in reality, but this shit is a cartoon, fucking lawless darkness everywhere, just no safety. You know, like I said, there's no pain meds at the dentist. The dentist has a secret trap room under his dental chair. They tell everyone they meet that they're detectives working on a case. Professor Rowbottom invites them to England to solve his crime, but makes them stay at an inn for 2 days. And then after 2 days, he's like, oh yeah, why don't you guys stay with me? Like, motherfucker, you made them waste money on a hotel? Like, what? Doesn't make any sense. The police,
like, pointless shit like that. Like, it's completely pointless to have that little thing happen.
Yeah. And like the police, like Chris said earlier, you know, they just accept any explanation and let everyone go and never really investigate anything. We talked about how an entire house is robbed with multiple floors and two basements without disturbing the guy who lives on site. Chris, your favorite. Do you want to talk about your favorite?
Another favorite moment, yes, is that there's the scene where they go into the locksmith's shop because they find like an impression of a key in a divot in the sub basement or something.
Oh, right.
They were
so
like, can you like reverse engineer the key?
Yes, yes. So they go to the locksmith because they're hoping he can reverse engineer the key. Correct. Yes. I had forgotten that. That's why I'm restating it for myself.
Yes. And so like he's like, sure, just go into the back room and wait. And then they're like, okay, that's cool. We'll go into the back room with all the medieval weapons and armor in there. And he locks them in. And they're like, oh, shit, we're in a scrape. We better figure our way out of it. And Frank's like, I got an idea. Be quiet now. And then they get into the suits of armor quietly.
Yes.
Like, it just says, like, they, like, slip into... I don't care who the fuck you are, Paris. You're not getting into armor, perhaps the noisiest clothing imaginable, unless you're wearing a shirt made of screams. Like there's... How do you get into armor silently?
Yeah, I... Dude, this is armor is a topic close to Chris and my heart. You know, if you know anything about us, and I can't imagine that, especially because I think it was actually historical, like not ancient but old armor, right? It wasn't like new.
Yes,
it was like an antique. And so the other thing that kills me is like, you need other people to help you fucking get into armor. It is not a solo project. This is not your hit single.
The book treats it like the armor was standing up and there's like a front half of the armor and then you can like kind of like just slide into the armor from behind or something.
I don't know. But they each get into the armor on their own and then they just pretend they are the suits of armor. And the guy comes in and is like, oh no, I guess they're gone. And that's how they get out of that one.
Legitimately the most Scooby-Doo thing to possibly happen.
Oh wait, I'll one up you on that... nope, I'll one up you on the Scooby-Doo-ness. So
okay.
They're was it actually after this incident they're running away from some pursuers, you know, presumably the evil black witches or whatever, and they escape to the underground, to the subway.
Mm-hmm.
And they realize, like, oh man, these people are still tailing them. Like, they're, you know, the tailors are tailing. They have not lost them. And finally, they decide that they're going to get off the train into a crowd on a platform. And as they get off the train, they're going to put on their Irish boy rubber masks from the dentist. And they put them on, and the pursuers just can't see them anymore. And I was like, you're wearing the same clothes. Also, you're wearing an entire rubber mask over your entire head. How does that not stick out so obviously? I don't care how crowded it is. A plastic head is not a person.
Masks are.
Yeah, I guess that's supposed to be, you know, the case. But even still, I think that is just Scooby-Doo shit. It makes
especially
no sense.
Since how you spot people from afar, at least in my world, maybe it's different for you sighted people. How I can spot people from afar is by the clothing.
Yes. Yes, that is correct. Because like
not the face.
Yeah. I mean, especially at that distance, right? Because they were a ways behind them, you know, they were on the same train, but not on the same car. So yeah, I was like, if you didn't change your clothes and then you're putting on something that basically screams, look at me, I'm a fucking weirdo. I got a giant rubber mask on my head. I just don't get it. Ugh. There's another, you know, this book also has a case of like the everyone knows everyone else disease where, you know, they meet a random girl on a beach in was it the Isle of Man or in Ireland mainland? I forget.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, turns out her dad served in the military under someone at one of the castles that they were at. And then it turns out like the butler from one castle has a sister-in-law at the neighboring castle. All the black and white witches know each other. It's just, oh man, it just kills me. Like, I know the UK isn't huge or anything, but it's got a big enough population.
The UK is a small town. Don't try that in a small town, which is the UK.
Don't try that on the Isle of Man. I'm sure the Isle
or Scotland or London or East Anglia or really anywhere.
Well, to be fair, the Isle of Man is very small, but it really strains believability. some other stupid things that happen are like they go on a stakeout of Stonehenge because they anticipate that the Black Witches will be there for reasons. I forget if
they receive a note that's like, come to Stonehenge.
Wait, really?
And they're like, that doesn't sound like a trap.
Do they really get a note that tells them to go there?
Yes, they get a note that's like, come to Stonehenge.
I didn't remember that aspect. So the professor drives them out there. They get out of the car. Well, they get into like a very minor car accident on the way there, which also just is needless.
Yeah, there's no reason for it.
So I wouldn't even call it a car accident. Like the professor just goes, whoa, and like drives them off the road into a ditch and he bonks his head on the steering wheel. And the kids are like, oh, you bonked your head. You probably shouldn't drive. And he's like, no, it's fine. I'll get you up the road further. And then, you know, I'll wait here while you guys go investigate. So they go.
I'll take a nap after that. In fact, you know, I might have a concussion, but I feel real sleepy, and I think I should just really saw some logs over here, boys.
Yeah, just do the one thing you're not supposed to do after you hit your head. And so he stays behind. They go to Stonehenge. They get punched in the throat, like thrown into some bushes because they got to get conked again by goons. And when they finally come to, they go to walk back to the car, and the professor's gone, and they're like, the fuck? And they were like, shit, is the professor bad and in on this? And it turns out what actually happened was that they got attacked by, you know, the bad evil witch goons. And then one of the people involved in the evil witch goon conspiracy just walked up to the professor's car and handed him a note and said, oh, I just saw the boys. They told you to head on home and give you this. And the professor's like, okay, stranger in the middle of the night. Bye. And just drive
totally reasonable.
Home. And just
I don't want to be here anyway. Fuck those kids.
Just abandon them. Why would you not be immediately suspicious of anyone walking up to you with a note?
We came here specifically to investigate crime and a suspicious note that we got. And the professor was like, oh, it seems reasonable that someone would just tell me to leave. I better go home.
Why wouldn't the boys have come back to the car and said that to you? They weren't far away. Like, it's makes absolutely no sense. And then later, when they're, you know, sort of getting closer to solving the crime, they just go for a very obvious trap with no backup plan. They pay some dudes to kidnap them. And then they are surprised when they end up in a torture chamber. I'm not kidding. They hear about...
There's no glossing over happening
no,
here.
No, they hear about an exhibit of witch artifacts, and they know it's some of the stuff from the professor's collection because it was like the Matthew Hopkins shit or whatever. They were like, that's definitely his stuff. So they know the people running the exhibit are probably behind it, especially because they're super sketchy and weird and like aren't very nice to them. And they're like, you can only see it if you pay us $40 and let us put like bags over your heads. And they're like, fine. So they...
Sure, kidnap us immediately.
So they split in two.
We'll even pay you to do it.
Yeah, so they split into groups of two. I forget. So Joe and Frank go and they're like, "What? We're going to go and go to the secret place to see the collection." And then the other two, I don't remember what their... role was.
Chet and Pat. Chet commonly, I remember Chet from other Hardy Boys novels. He's just like sort of a dopey sidekick type.
Yeah, I don't remember what their job was, but in any case, these two assholes pay people to kidnap them. They get bags put over their heads. They get driven away and they're like, uh-oh. What did you think was going to happen? You were pretty sure these were the these were the perpetrators of the crime, and then you gave them money to kidnap you. Why are you surprised by anything that's happening? So they get taken to a torture chamber. They have their hoods taken off. They're literally strapped to the rack or different kinds of racks where they turn a lever and they pull all their limbs or whatever. They give them a potion that's supposed to like, I don't know, keep them awake or something, even though it's not nighttime. I don't know. And then just as they're about to torture them and they give them the potion and everything, this light goes off and they're like, oh no, people are here. So they take Joe and Frank off the racks and put the hoods back over them and are like attempting to move them to a third location. And I just don't let people into the torture chamber. It's not hard. Just keep them in the torture chamber, which is probably soundproof.
You actually can't come in. We're torturing in here.
Just put him in the tea room. Tell him to go away. Pretend you're not home.
Vestibule.
Yeah, like, why? I just don't.
No one's home. Like, the classic move that we all do now when someone rings the doorbell, you just don't answer,
yes.
Actually. It's totally. I guess in the 70s, common courtesy was so strong that, like, well, if someone's at the torture chamber door, what do you want me to ignore them? I'm not a monster. I'm just a torturer.
Yeah, we can't possibly do that.
I'm not rude.
And so, you know, of course, as they're trying to smuggle them out, turns out, you know, the people who were ringing the bell is like Mr. Evans. Evans, not Eames. Mr. Evans, the daughter that they made friends with, and I forget, I don't know, the whole kit and caboodle. They're all there to save the day because Mr. Evans knew that the Black Witches were meeting at Craigmore. And it's like, that was an essential part of the mystery. They were trying to figure that out. Why didn't you just fucking tell them? Why didn't you fucking tell them the last time you saw them? Like, this would have...
Well, you never asked. You didn't ask me about where the Black Witches meet that I happen to know, which I will not tell you why I happen to know.
Oh, my God. And so, you know, they get into a scuffle and then the, I don't know, police show up and people get arrested. And then they're like, well, we still haven't figured out what the key goes to. And, you know, they realize that a bunch of the people who work at the castles were, like, you know, part of the conspiracy. They were some of the goons. And they force one of the evil housekeepers to show them where the key goes because they tried every door in one of the castles and couldn't figure it out. And then Frank or Joe remember seeing a window on the outside of a turret that they didn't see, like, a corresponding
from the
door
inside.
For on the inside or whatever. So, which, whatever, sure. So they get the woman to show them there's, like, a secret panel, and it and behind the panel there's a door, and of course that's the key that opens the door, and turns out there's the body of Lord Craighead, the guy who disappeared 5 years ago, and looks like he, I don't know, he was, like, doing black magic with the dentist and someone else, and then, I don't know, he died because he drank a potion that wasn't made right, and then they just left his body in there. I still don't quite understand that whole thing. And then the dentist became the new witchmaster. And then he, I don't know, like, plunged them into poverty or something. And they were like, we needed to steal to fund our occult practices. We didn't have any money left. And so it's just capitalism again, even though it should have been Satan this time.
Turns out, you know, not even Satan, really.
So turns out they robbed the witchcraft collection because they needed to sell it off so they could fund their fucking torture chambers and mask making. Really lame ending to this.
Yeah. Also, the whole arson thing was just kind of like, oh, by the way, there's the hat. We figured it out because of the hat.
Yeah, and then they wrap up the other property thing. And they figure out that the body that was behind the door that was locked was the Lord Craigmore, Craighead, who disappeared, because inside his collar, it literally says, this garment made for Lord Craigmore... or Craighead or whatever, which is ridiculous. And I don't know if you would actually embroider the full name of the person that you made a garment for in the collar. I mean,
rich people clothing is very custom and bespoke, so
yeah,
you might request that.
I guess, but it just seemed a little, yeah, I don't know.
I don't know, if you're doing crimes, maybe don't leave your shirt with your name on it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, don't do that. All right.
So don't wear that one to the crime.
Get a Fruit of the Loom for criming, you know? Just get something basic.
Yeah,
go to
right.
Target.
Nice and easy. Okay, negative one for plot, right?
Oh, absolutely. Character quality, we're talking paper dolls here. None of these people are believable as actual human beings for all the reasons we've already explained. Let's move on to... moment to moment.
I mean, this is a zero for me, and I don't really have much to say after all of that plot nonsense we went through. Like, it's certainly a functioning book, as we said before, and sure, the dialogue is very like, boy gee golly, we got conked by them goons. My favorite part in that moment is, like, there's a point where Frank and Joe are like just standing outside somewhere and someone turns a hose on them and is like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to turn that hose on you. And Frank just goes, well, he's a cool customer.
Yeah. The, The dialogue feels very cliched and stilted, especially because of, like Chris just said, you know, sort of the dialectical flavor of the time. It's a lot of like, gee, jolly, geez, zap, zap, ah, you know, it's just so silly.
So, I mean, I don't know if I want to like say that's negative one, but it's just like it's a little dated and hokey, which is to be expected for a book published in the 70s. But there's books published in the 70s that don't feel that way either.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know.
And, you know, like we said, the sentence is certainly sentence, but it's not good. I can just read a couple of quick passages to get the general flavor here.
Yes.
All right. They are searched. This is when they're initially searching Professor Rowbottom's manor, castle, museum house. Let's see. A narrow stairway met their eyes. It fell deeply into total darkness. Obviously, the sub-basement is not connected to the master switch. Maybe there's a separate one downstairs, Frank said. He descended the staircase, guiding himself with a flashlight he had brought along. There's the switch, he said, flicking on a dim bulb and returning the flashlight to his pocket. They found themselves in a musty dark room with a ceiling so low they could touch it by raising a hand. The flagstones that made up the floor were interspersed with ancient tombstones. If rheumatism is your bag, Joe quipped, this is the place to get it. Hope we can get a clue to the burglary, Frank said. I'll start on the opposite side. You begin here. We can compare notes after scouting around. Okay, Joe said. Frank started across the stone floor. Joe walked along the wall next to the staircase. The clammy chill of the place began to seep into their bones. Joe shivered. It's like being buried alive! Pick your gravestone, Frank joked, then added seriously. Wait a minute, I see something! Joe, look at this! Frank had hardly spoken when the light went out. The Hardys were plunged into utter darkness! The end of a chapter is kind of what we were talking about, you know.
That's the cliffhanger. Oh, it got dark. Oh no. By the way, it was just like the breaker went off.
Yeah,
that's
the
all.
The fucking next two lines is like, oh, they got a flashlight, and they're like, oh, someone fiddled with the fuse box, or a fuse blew by itself.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
It acts like the fuse being in the down position or the you know, the opposite position is a sign that it was tampered with, but that's just what they
just
do.
What happens when a fuse blows? Jesus Christ. All right, yeah, let's give that a zero, because it did at least snap by and it was
that's a zero for the moment to moment.
All right, Terriblo's presence.
Okay.
Where are we with our Dark Lord?
I mean, like, we're certainly saying huh a lot here for all the reasons we said before. The like, chaos levels aren't super high, I suppose, but we were definitely going huh a lot, and we definitely went to each other for assistance many, many times through the reading of this one. But it's not the ominous sort of Terriblo's presence here, right? This is Saturday morning cartoon Terriblo.
This is like we're little
like
ants that he's
eyes.
Poking with a stick. Like, he's just kind of nudging us. He's not burning us with the light of the sun through a magnifying glass. He's just kind of fucking up our little anthills. You know, he's here. He's just sort of fucking with us. I don't think he's doing anything interdimensionally nightmarish, but he is making us question cause and effect and humans.
Yeah.
So he's here.
Still a negative one.
Yeah.
Still a negative,
still a
one,
negative
here,
one,
I would say. But, like, it's not like a threatening,
you know,
negative
and I'm
one.
I'm just gonna list off, and I know you've heard me say these a couple times, but just
for effect.
Yeah, just so you can remember the number of sort of once-in-a-lifetime scenarios that happen with no consequence or no thought. Like, the boys don't really seem to hang on any of this very long. Witnessing an occult funeral in the daytime. Dentist with a creepy-ass secret room. No pain meds for a tooth that was just ripped from your face without anesthetic. Getting knocked out and tossed into an open grave. Getting punched in the neck and tossed into some bushes. Poisoned by a woman with a needle in the palm. Immediate doctor with antidote to said needle palm poison. They almost get Stephen King's Miseried, which we didn't talk about.
We mentioned it in the summary.
There's a terrorist shooting in the airport. Their boat sinks and they are rescued at sea. And finally, a satanic torture chamber. All of that in what, 4 days? 3 days?
Yeah,
something like that.
Just about.
Something like that.
Yeah, they're on their adventures. The Hardy Boys lifestyle there, man.
The part where they almost get miseried is like another thing that just didn't need to happen and didn't make any sense. They decide, you know,
they're hitchhiking back from Stonehenge.
Yeah.
And the lady picks them up and she's like, well, you're going to come home with me for a nice rest. And they're like, no. And she's like, well, we're going to do that. And they're like, no. And they just bail out of the car and make it all the way back home with a different person. It was like, there's no need for any.
No. Why do we need to know that this woman almost abducted you? I mean, it's weird, but why does it need to happen in this book? It doesn't.
It doesn't add. Just write that they got back to the professor's place. I'm like, hey, what the fuck, professor? Like, that's all you really need.
Yeah. Why couldn't they have taken a fucking taxi or gone to a nearby house and been like, hey, can we use your phone? Like, it's Stonehenge. Is Stonehenge that? All right. Now I need a map. Is Stonehenge that far from?
Kind of.
I don't know. Well, have you been there? I've never been.
No, I have not been to Stone. I didn't even get to see any standing stones when I was in Scotland. I should have, I could have touched them and gone back.
Oh, okay. That's what I was thinking of then. Okay. Well, it's... I mean, there's a Mandalay Holiday Home like 5 miles down the road. They could have just...
Well, now,
maybe not in the 70s, but... There's enough towns nearby that if they had just walked, they would have, found like a house. So I don't.
Yeah, quite... and people are opening the door. They're answering the door. They answered the door at the torture chamber. Someone at home would have like opened up for them, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, sure, it would have sucked for a few miles of walking, but there's town centers not far from there. So I don't know.
And even then, even if you say like, well, if it's natural to try to hitchhike too, you just don't need to include the scene where there's some weird lady.
Yeah.
There's no, yeah. That's really the point.
You don't need another near kidnapping in a book where you're going to get kidnapped anyway. Just let the kidnapping take its course naturally.
Okay. So I think we're going to say -1 for Tariblo's presence as well.
Yes. Tariblo is here.
All right, so that brings us to the final category. Should this exist,
Hell
Paris?
To the fucking no. Hell
no. No, also a negative one. Like, this is number 55. I think you could have called it earlier in the Hardy Boys Adventures. Or just, maybe just not this one. Like, you get this manuscript in from Vincent, or whatever his name was, and you're just like, I don't know, Vince, maybe a little bit less tomfoolery here. Like, or just make it a Scooby-Doo story instead. Just make it Shaggy... and the gang.
Or, I mean...
it might have been fun.
Well, and the thing is, you still could have... You could have had some of these elements and made it an okay story. It wouldn't have been great, but it would have been fine. This is so absurd. It's not even good if you're just looking for an easy mystery, because none of it made sense, including how they solve the case. Do we feel the author's goal was met? No, unless this goal was just to get a few sweet pennies.
Yeah, it's real sloppy, man.
Yeah, does it add anything new, interesting, or novel? No. Did it take something from us? Yes.
I believe so. it ruined a little bit of my childhood nostalgia, actually.
Sorry, Chris.
For Hardy Boys books, so it did take that away from me.
Wow, that's rough. What's our final score?
So we did 1 for technical construction, the only positive score it got. We got -1 for the plot, so that's just as flat... Now. 0 for moment to moment, -1 for Tariblo's presence, and -1 for Should This Exist. So a -2 out of 5 for The Witchmaster's Key.
I really feel like
number
it 55
should be with the Hardy Boys
even
series.
Lower than that, but I'm sticking to the rubric. So, can we fix this? Yes, but it would involve a complete rewrite, including the idea that two 17-year-old or a 17 and 19-year-old are out here like fighting crime and getting hired like it's totally normal. Mind your accents. Do your research on anything that touches on real events. Get rid of the stupid fake occult shit. There's plenty of more real occult stuff you could have referenced, especially in the 70s. Why didn't they just go with, Aleister Crowley's sex party route? That would have been real.
Well, it's for Paris. It's a series for small boys.
Aleister Crowley's slumber party. Fine. Okay. Whatever.
Just non-sexual Aleister Crowley's slumber party.
Non-sexual smoking drinking party. And it just would have been a lot better. I mean, especially if the crime wasn't just, oh, we stole the stuff because we needed money.
Just make them do it for the occult, because they're practicing witches, so they just steal it because that's all the cool witch shit. We could really use that.
Yeah, it was very silly. So fuck this. I am so glad I never read Hardy Boys. This is really bad. I'm sorry, Chris, that this was your experience with literature as a kid.
Yeah, we're gonna have something to say in part two regarding that, I think. But as I mirror your examples of how we can fix this pretty much entirely. You would need a ground up rewrite. You'd have to untangle a lot of weird stuff that happens that isn't necessarily there. I'd probably cut 40% of this book right out to begin with.
Hollow it out like a fucking gourd at Halloween time.
It's just like, okay, let's just get down to the brass tacks of someone stole a museum. Let's start there and like just figure out like how we spool out from there. All right, but Paris, -2/5.
Yeah.
Thanks for ruining my childhood. And thank you to the patrons for supporting us in my childhood ruining. Thanks to the Bad Bookworms, Emily, Ben, Bleach Black Cat, Renee, Scott H., Donnie, Anya, Lycoris, Jakob, Jared, and Will. Our exacting editors, Rudy Bo, Buddy, The Ugly One, Emmy, Harry Seven, Funny Robot with Antennas, David, Martin, Kieran, Elliot, D, and Greg. The Loathsome Librarians of the Void, the Taco Eating Unicorn, Robin, Beast with the Least, Austin, Patricia, Veronica, Lucek, Senior, and Arant. Our pesky publishers, Julius the Nice Dragon, Miles May, and our newest patron, Fred Jones. Thank you for joining, Fred Jones. You're welcome to join the terrible crew. And, of course, our Ko-fi donor, Kiwi Thing, who recently gave us another Ko-fi donation. Thank you, Kiwi Thing.
Thank you.
Will anyone accept the challenge to become an arch-archivist this year? What heinous, monstrous tome will you force us to read? It's kind of getting late in the schedule already. Well, not that late, but, you know, it's like it's... We're well into this already, so time is running out.
Yeah, we're running ahead of schedule, folks. You want to make us read something horrible, you get in there. Get in there like Fred and Miles did.
Yeah, okay. Well, Paris, I'm off to hitchhike back home because I'm actually sitting here right after a Graveborn drum recording session has wrapped up. Actually, they're probably packing the drums in the studio right now. I was like, I got to go do this podcast. See you later, jerks.
Wow. What are you, a singer? What are you, me?
I know, that's the vibe I was giving off there. But anyway, yeah, so I'm just going to hitchhike, I guess, back over to the studio once we're done here. Hopefully a weird lady doesn't try to misery me on the way over there. But we'll find out.
I hope so.
All right, Paris, see you later.
All right, see you later for episode 2, where we talk about my beloved childhood books, Dear America. See you next week, folks.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Terrible Book Club. Terrible Book Club is an independent podcast produced by your hosts, Paris and Chris. Sound design and audio editing by Chris, with sound effects and music by Epidemic Sound and sometimes also Chris. Our theme song is Kiss by Yearn, which is, you guessed it, actually also Chris. You can find more of his soothing synthy sounds on Bandcamp at yearn.bandcamp.com. Do you want us to review a book of your choice on the show? Do you want access to some extra audiovisual weirdness? If so, become a patron at patreon.com/terriblebookclub. If you'd like to send us a one-time tip instead, you can do that at ko-fi.com/terriblebookclub. You can also support TBC for free by sharing the show on social media, following our accounts on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or Goodreads, telling your friends about your favorite episode, or by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, or anywhere else on the internet. To send us book recommendations or your adorable pet photos, send an email to terriblebookclub@gmail.com.